America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. The following podcast may be quite disturbing if you're under the impression that our right to informed consent as it relates to our medical care is getting broader and more expansive. In fact, despite HIPAA rules and filling out lots of forms that we think protect us as patients, assuring a sign-off on what happens to us, laws over the last 25 years have moved in favor of the medical community and away from the control of required sign-offs to put us in trials and subject us to procedures we little understand. Get ready to learn a lot today and perhaps be none too happy with what's revealed on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Harriet Washington, and she wrote a book that was so compelling years back called Medical Apartheid. And now she has weighed in once again on issues related to medical bioethics with the book Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent. And Harriet, just tell us the linkage between these two fine books and what separates one from the next.
Both Medical Apartheid and Carte Blanche deal with ethical abuses, typically in the research arena. Medical Apartheid focuses on the abuse of African Americans over four centuries of American history. And Carte Blanche is a contemporary book in that I write about what's happening right now, what's been happening over the last few decades in terms of robbing people of what we think of as the essential right to informed consent, to say yes or no to medical research and treatment. However, Carte Blanche talks about dangers to all Americans, not just African Americans or people of color. All Americans can fall victim to the new research regulations that allow people to do research on people who have not given their permission.
For most of us, we think that we do give consent, or that it is required, or that the ethical standards of medicine would require our full knowledge and consent. But I've got to tell you, in the book, you really startle me with so many examples where that is not the case, and not only with captive audiences like prisoners, but with the rest of us as well.
Exactly. Maybe a big difference between the past abuse of research and today's is that in many cases, it's perfectly legal today. And it is a shocking thing to realize. Ever since Nuremberg, we have assumed that we have the right to say yes or no to medical research. We definitely think we have the right to know when we've been up in the medical research trial. But since 1996, changes in the law have allowed researchers to dispense with informed consent and conduct their research studies without letting people know that they're in clinical trials, without letting them know that they are research subjects. And that's frankly shocking to me. And I think it'll be shocking to a lot of Americans.
Yeah. Now, first of all, we think when we are progressing or going forward into a modern age, that in fact a practice like this would be less acceptable than ever before, particularly 50 years after the abuses that the Nuremberg Code was meant to help to ameliorate. And yet we're going backward, even at the time when we have HIPAA laws and various requirements where I can't even give my surname when I go in for a medical procedure.
You're right. It's unmooring to think of this. I think of Alfred Lord North Whitehead said that progress is not always forward progress. We're not always progressing toward a better society. We like to think that we are, but sometimes we do regress. This is an example of that. And it's very hard to contemplate. We also think that we have a rich matrix of laws and regulations that we didn't have before Nuremberg, and we thought that will protect research subjects. But now we have laws that have actually made them more vulnerable.
Why is that?
My opinion is that a lot has to do, not everything, but a lot has to do with dramatic changes in the healthcare environment in 1980 was the year that officially corporations began to legally exploit and use patents and discoveries made in universities and to begin to commercialize them. Before then, universities did not tend to turn over their patented discoveries and molecules to corporations. But 1980 law made that easier to do, and very quickly corporations began to evolve to pursue and dictate the American medical agenda. It's my opinion, as I dictate it in my book, Deadly Monopolies, it's my opinion that that's why we today have 20 drugs for erectile dysfunction and nothing new works for malaria, because corporations exist to make profits. And they're pursuing the drugs that will make them the most money, which are not always the drugs that we need. So it used to be that universities and medical researchers wanted to be seen as benefactors and wanted to solve pressing medical problems, would take an agenda that was actually compatible with our needs. When we needed treatment for polio, we wanted polio vaccines. You know, they were driven by what people needed, but corporations are driven by making money. And if they can devise a blockbuster drug for erectile dysfunction, that's exactly what they will do. That's also the reason, in my opinion, why medications cost so much. And the patent system gives them at least 20 years of exclusivity, which can often be extended. And that means that they can charge any price they want for pills. And that's why we have cancer drugs that cost $1 million a year. And to me, the shorthand is that people in the developing world, wealthy Western countries like ours, go bankrupt trying to pay for these medications. People in the developing world simply die.
Carte Blanche is the book, The Erosion of Medical Consent. You start off the book, so I want to go back to it, because I think people really need a window into understanding what you're talking about. You start off with a case of a nursing home called The Resort in Texas City to illustrate your point about informed consent, Dr. Robin Armstrong. Just shorthand that case for us.
In May of 2020, he began giving hydroxychloroquine to the nursing home patients and employees. A lot of the patients, of course, were elderly. In fact, most of them were elderly, if not all. And Dr. Armstrong began telling people, newspapers, anyone who would listen, that the drug he was giving them was curing them. They were no longer sick with COVID-19. They never developed COVID-19 because of the drug. He said it was a miracle drug, and he's giving it to everyone. Several problems to this. One was that he wasn't divulging his data. He was just making the claim. Another was he was not getting permission of the elderly patients. If he had been, many of them could not legally give their permission. They weren't competent. And in cases like that, doctors talk to the family members, typically, if the family members are available. But Dr. Armstrong didn't do that. And when the reporters asked him, why didn't you talk to their family members? He said, if I call the family members, if I want to give them medication, that's all I do. I'd be on the phone all the time talking to family members. So, he just, poo-pooed the idea that he should be offering consent. Well, when the other people analyzed his numbers, I think it was the Board of Health, I'm not certain about that. When they analyzed his numbers, they found that actually it was not a miracle drug. People who are dying, people were not being protected against coronavirus 19. There was quite a furor when it turned out that there were people who had been infected in the nursing home who may or may not have gotten appropriate treatment. It's kind of difficult to find out. It's sort of a, case of one person's word against another. But the bottom line was the Galveston County Health District didn't verify his claims of success. And the reason why this drug was being used at all, as most of us know, is because President Trump had praised it. This happened with a number of drugs that President Trump praised, ended up being approved for use, but turned out to have either no efficacy or perhaps worse than no efficacy. The thing was that the sacred right to consent is something that usually is located in people, but when people are not competent, like the elderly patients, we rely upon the families to give consent for the patient or whoever they have designated. But that was just ignored here. And very frequently during coronavirus 19, we find that the right to informed consent is being ignored. This is not surprising. This happens during periods of medical emergencies, whether they're pandemics or during wartime. Anything that creates urgency creates a certain slackening in observing right to consent. And unfortunately, it becomes a thin edge of the wedge. You know, you begin with nursing home patients during pandemic, but you end up with something to function creep. You end up with, you know, dispensing with informed consent for large groups of people. So it's very problematic. Even small abuses like this have a way of mushrooming.
But the point of your book is that there are so many groups over the years who have been taken in, not being given the opportunity to give informed consent, oftentimes no consent. And we are talking about prisoners. We're talking about people in the military. We're talking about the aged, those who are powerless, whether it be by ethnicity or status in life. They are being taken advantage of by the medical system. You point that out time and again in your book.
Exactly. The medical system benefits because it's much easier to conduct research when you don't have to go to the trouble of informing people of all the risks and potential benefits and potential changes in their health status that could be caused by the, if you can just give it to them without getting a yes or no, that makes your job easier and it makes developing the drug and testing it much cheaper. And so we find that huge swathes of people, we've had everything tested from artificial blood to ketamine. Remember the death of Elijah McCain? Wasn't that long ago? The young man stopped by the police, confronted by them, who claimed that he was agitated. But here is a man who, in his spare time, played violin for shelter dogs because he thought they needed to be calmed down and soothed. He does not sound like someone who needs to be restrained by the police as he's walking home. But that's exactly what happened, and he was injected with ketamine as part of a research study that was non-consensual. And it's being carried out not only in Colorado where he lived, it's being carried out in Minneapolis. And so they're injecting people. It's ambulance attendants, by the way, not doctors doing this. And very often the claim is that police are urging the ambulance attendants to inject the people. And he was injected, and the next day he was dead. It's not an unknown result, because injecting ketamine in people often results in robbing them of the ability to breathe. And a high percentage of people who are injected end up in a ventilator. So you end up in a ventilator on the hospital the next day. And only then do you discover that you've been involved in medical research, which was permitted by a change in the law in 1996. But it's too late for you. You already have breathing problems. You might have other problems resulting from it. No one ever asked if you wanted to be in this research study, but yet there you are.
Now, we are at a time, and Harry, you've got to help me understand this, at a time when we have an organization fighting hard to keep animals out of various medical experiments, PETA saying that it's cruel, it's unusual, these animals should not be subjected to this. And here you are telling us that, and you set it back to the 1980s, and then there was some changes in law in 1996, which basically make it easier to not inform somebody that they are going to be part of something that could be very dangerous for themselves. I mean, what is the justification? The only one I could imagine anybody could come up with is the fact that it's for the greater good. That we have some testing done, whether individuals are easy to find to be part of that study group or not. But that, to me, is not justification enough.
No, it's not. And that's actually poor justification, but it's better than the one that's used. I'm going to confess that I have never really understood justification, but here it goes. So for one of the 1996 changes, it said if you're a trauma victim, and trauma victims are a very broad group of people. You can be in a car accident, be shot in the chest. You can have many things happen to you, but a trauma victim who is unconscious can be enrolled in medical research without asking his permission. The rationale is, are you ready for this? They're unconscious, and so you can't explain informed consent to them.
Oh, okay.
So because they're unconscious and you can't offer informed consent, it's considered appropriate to give them no consent and simply force them into the study. It has never made sense to me. It's convenient, as I pointed out before, it's convenient for filling up your study very cheaply and quickly, but there's no ethical justification, in my opinion. And add to that the fact that the law assumes that the person is unconscious. Not every trauma victim is unconscious. Not every trauma victim remains unconscious. I wrote about one woman who was indeed unconscious but woke up in the ambulance in time to see what she described to me as blood. I woke up in the ambulance and they were giving me blood. And I had to tell her that wasn't blood.
Yeah. Now, I've got to tell you, that story alone, first of all, I was riveted by your account of polyheme, is it called?
Yes.
And the study of 720 unwitting U.S. and Canadian subjects. And I learned a whole lot about blood and how, you know, you need to have a certain type, of course, and with the immediacy of the need and the various oxygen levels that the blood is carrying, the impact. So you really did lay that out very, very clearly for us. Do you want to say anything more about the blood substitute and that particular study?
I could talk about that all day, so please don't let me do that. But there's a lot more to be said. You know, in retrospect, one of the most chilling things about this is I found out after I'd done a lot of research, at the very end of my research, that's when I found out that polyheme was only one of at least 8 very similar blood substitutes that had been tested. And in every single one of them, the result was the same. People who got them had higher rates of heart attacks and death than people who got the standard of care. So they were all dangerous, and all dangerous in the same way. And yet, studies kept getting approved to give them to people without their permission. So polyheme was, the thing is that ambulances don't carry blood. They can't. It requires refrigeration, and it's got to be typed and crossed. It would take up too much room and too much time. They carry saline, salt water. But if you live in a city or a suburb, saline is fine. It will keep you alive and keep you from going to shock long enough to get to a hospital. You know, almost everybody in this country who does not live out, in a rural area can get to a hospital in 20 minutes. So saline is fine. But they were concerned about people who live far from hospitals. How about people who live like a few hours or a few days to hospital? And who are these people? Usually they're soldiers. Soldiers in foreign fields. But they didn't test it in soldiers. There were one test I know of, one trial in soldiers. All the rest happened in people who lived in cities, who frankly, had this been found to be a safe and effective blood substitute, would not have been helped by it. Because frankly, saline would work for them just as well. But anyway, they're being tested without their will. The polyheme is put on the ambulance. So if the ambulance screams to your house after you have been shot in the chest or had a heart attack, before they treat you, they have to stop and open a computer printout that tells them what to give you, saline or polyheme. If you've ever worked on an ambulance or know anything about it, it seems to me that that's a really unconscionable waste of time. You know, you've seen them in action. They usually go right to start helping the people, but no, they're going to pause for the sake of the study and find out which to give them. So guided by this printout, they would give you either saline or polyheme. When you get to the hospital, guess what? Now blood is available, but you don't get blood if you're in a study. They keep giving you polyheme for 12 more hours. Why? Because it's better for you? No, it's better for the study. The study required that it be given for that long, so even though that is not going to improve your health, and for all I know, it might even worsen your chance of recovering, that's what happened. And in the end, they found that people who had received polyheme, 720 people in the study, to receive the polyheme were more likely to have a heart attack or die. They did not tell the people they'd been in the study. The one woman I profiled in my book was told by her daughter that she was in the study. No one ever told her. So it's completely unconscionable. And again, this is a substance that we already knew did not work well. It had already been tested repeatedly. And frankly, to be, you know, technical, as an ethicist, that violates something called equipoise. All that means is that equipoise means that you can't do a research study if you already know the answer. If you already know that something is better than standard of care or less good than standard of care, then you can't ethically give it to someone.
Carte Blanche is the book,
And Harriet Washington is making in this book a compelling case that we need to re-arrive at the point of consent, that it has to be restored to American medical research. And I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you are interested in this topic, but you probably didn't know that we don't often consent to things that occur to us within the context of medical care. And I've got to tell you, the part of the book that really hit me between the eyes, many parts did, many of the stories that you recount, but when you did the side-by-side comparison in page 49 through, I think it's 51, of various things that Nazi Germany did, and then various things that we do and have done and continue to do in the United States, that was a revelation, and that was, well, startling.
I am very glad you shared that with me, because I'm going to admit that I was really, really conflicted about that. I put that chart in the book and took it out more times than I care to tell you, because one of the things I have a strong aversion to, and I think other people do too, is, you know, some comparisons to the murderous abuses of Nazi Germany are downright insulting. You know, if it's not done in the proper way, sometimes people make false equivalencies, you mm-hmm. know, and that can be very insulting to the survivors of the Holocaust and their families and the people who were affected by it. To me, you have to be tread really carefully there. So believe me, I did a lot of soul searching before I put that chart in, but in the end I had to, because I thought it was really important for people to understand how egregious these acts are. And I think that by, you know, summoning up the ghost of the Holocaust, always a painful thing, an ugly thing, but it was important for people to see that we're not somehow immune to these kind of abuses. You know, we like to think of ourselves as so advanced and actually protected by our aggressive education and that we're not monsters. But the fact is, if you're not careful, if you're not vigilant, any society can fall to that level. And I really thought that chart illustrated that in a powerful way. Because
oh, absolutely.
We are doing things.
You got my attention. I mean, do you want to give one or more, I sure did, one or more of the comparisons that you drew in that chart?
I'll talk about one that, frankly, is not the best, not the closest comparison, closest parallel. It's close, but not the most close one. But I want to talk about it because it's something that's happening today that I'm really concerned about. And that is hypothermia studies. Right now, in Baltimore and, for all I know, maybe elsewhere, but definitely in Baltimore, there are studies underway that have been described in the New Yorker article and then later in a New Scientist article. And basically, you've got a principal investigator, a physician, who is inducing hypothermia in patients. Now, causing hypothermia is counterintuitive. Hypothermia is deadly. It's something that you try to fight, to reverse. When I was in upstate New York and worked in a hospital there, that was a life-threatening emergency. You pull out all the stops. People often died. And you can get hypothermic, you know, by being in an ATV accident or being in a car that breaks down in a desolate area or just being out in bad weather, ill-fated hiking excursions.
Well, I saw recently in Dallas where an 11-year-old boy or Texas, when they had that cold snap
right.
and they lost power, an 11-year-old boy died of it.
Exactly, exactly. And it's deadly. You know, even with treatment, many people don't survive. But they are making people hypothermic intentionally, and the New York article described it as an attempt to find out why some people who are exposed to cold temperatures survive. You know, children who drown, for example, but they drown in very cold water, occasionally are able to be resuscitated. They actually survive. And they're thinking, maybe something about the cold that's curative. But frankly, it sounds very vague and inchoate. And I was more disturbed when the article said they were focusing on doing it, focusing on conducting this study to find out if hypothermia would increase survival in black men. And I'm thinking, why black men? The article said, well, because it's a group that often suffers from gunshots, and we're studying hypothermia as a treatment for gunshots. I mean, it set off any number of alarm bells in my head, first of all. being vulnerable to gunshot wounds, being shot by a gun, like, is not, it's not an excuse for being a research subject. It's not a good indication of being a research subject. You're already vulnerable. You've been shot. And now you're going to be in a pool where people are going to be using this very questionable research. Well, the other thing is that the language again was vague. Well, very often it's black men who suffer gunshot wounds. That's a stereotype. If you, America is gun happy, we have a lot of gun deaths, but most of the people shot in this country the year that article came out and the subsequent years are white. White men, 9,000 white men died from gunshot wounds in 2016. Only 6,000 black men did. So if that were actually an indication, it would be white men you should be targeting, not black men. But of course, it's not an indication for anyone. So, but it does play into this empathy-damping stereotype about black men as being violent and engaging in gunplay. So that kind of troubled me. I mean, that troubled me very much. And then they talked about the fact that they were going to do this in this population, but of course not ask anyone's permission. The New Scientist article was even more troubling because as they talked about it, they called it, we're putting people into suspended animation. I'm thinking, what is a scientist fiction? And suspended animation is really bad semantics. You think of something that is reversible, as if you could control it. You can't. You can't control hypothermia. In fact, a good number of people with hypothermia die as they're trying to rewarm them. When they start coming back to life, when their body temperature comes up, that's actually a dangerous time for them. That's when the damage can cause death. So it's very tricky. You certainly cannot induce it and then suspend it and control that it will. And that was the implication in the article. Very troubling. You know, you're talking about targeting black men in these studies, but even if you hadn't been, the idea that you are going to target anyone with hypothermia, then when I read the original proposal, or at least the summary of the original proposal, I think was the first thing, but it said that the principal investigator was going to profit should the study be successful. He had patented some valves or devices that were used in the study, and the study was successful and found that hypothermia may indeed, you know, increase survivability. He would make money from this, which means it's a conflict of interest, which means he cannot be objective. There are, you know, so many reasons why this study should never be conducted.
And by the way, folks, I mean, as you're listening to this, we're talking about induced hypothermia as an experiment that's been going on in the U.S. And then side by side, what Harriet does quite brilliantly is put the Nazi research on freezing experiments. And until 1942, German Air Force doctors at Dachau, seeking the best way to warm flyers who landed in frigid waters, forced naked camp inmates to stand in freezing weather. But then she's all these other linkages, malaria, the way the Nazis did their research, the way we've done it, various things related to sea water and saline experiments. You really need to get this book. It is really important if these biomedical issues are important to you, carte blanche. Now, I've got to ask you this. Informed consent. Now, that assumes somebody has a certain knowledge of what is about to occur, that they are very cognizant at the moment that it's given. But you say that not only informed consent, but even simple consent have been withheld consistently in research with African Americans over many, many years. So give us the difference between informed consent, simple consent, and then where we are today as we look at this pandemic and COVID-19 and some of the reluctance that has been attributed to the minority community, perhaps even going back, of course, to the famous and infamous Tuskegee Airmen scandal that went on for 30 or 40 years.
All important. Informed consent is simply the provision of all the information that a subject could need to make a reasonable decision about whether or not they want to participate in the research. So you tell the subject, you know, what you're trying to do with the research, what exactly you expect to do, how you're going to do it. Are they going to be taking medication? Are they going to be using a device? What's going to happen? You give them all the alternatives. If you didn't want to be in the study, you could get treatment for X, you could get treatment for whatever condition you have or trying to avoid by doing A, B, C, or D, including doing nothing. And then you maintain that situation so that as the study progresses, anything that is found out that might affect the health or welfare or even the lifestyle of people in the study, you have to tell them that. If it turns out, for example, you find that the drug makes them unable to drive or unable to sleep well, all these things have to be told. They have to be maintained in a constant state of knowing everything that's important to know to make a decision. And they can withdraw from the study at any time, whether they've been paid or not, no matter what they have signed. All these things have to be conveyed to them. Now, in opposition to this, these studies that don't involve informed consent, they tell people nothing. And as you pointed out, very important, it's not just they're not getting informed consent, they're getting no consent at all. They frequently, in fact, typically don't know that they're in a research study. So they're given no chance to say yes or no. I want to be in this. I want out of this. They have no voice at all. So this is completely antithetical to what Americans think. We all assume we have the right to say yes or no to medical research. And what was the next thing you wanted to ask me about? Oh, yes, in terms of the effect on COVID-19, everything from some of the way that medications are given without getting informed consent from the subjects to changes in the provision of medical care. There's been a lot of withdrawing of medical care, withdrawing of rights. For example, now that hospitals and nursing homes are basically closed institutions where the family can't go to visit the person, there are things happening behind closed doors or proposed behind closed doors that would not be tolerated, I think, normally, and that many people don't know about. There are institutions that have considered, for example, withholding. In fact, ambulances have actually done this in Newark, LA, other places, withholding CPR from people they think have coronavirus so the attendants and EMTs won't be infected. Forcing DNR, do not resuscitate orders, on patients in hospitals and nursing homes, which means that if you were to take a turn for the worse, suddenly require dramatic care, it would be denied you. Typically, a DNR is something that you arrive at after you talk in detail with your doctor and you agree that in certain scenarios, receiving care would be worse than not getting any care. For example, elderly people, very elderly people who are frail, sometimes getting cardiac massage is dangerous. It can break their ribs, you know, causing lung problems. It can, you know, really ruin their quality of life, and it does not really necessarily extend their life. Many people, elderly people who get that kind of care in hospitals die in the hospital. They never come home to the hospital, but now they have all kinds of problems resulting from that. So knowing this, doctors will often advise you may want to say you don't want this care. And that's fine. That's a good thing. But holding the care wholesale from everybody, no matter their state of health, that is not. That's exactly what some institutions have been doing. In fact, the government began sending warning letters to some organizations saying what you're proposing to do violates the Americans with Disabilities Act. You can't do that. And there's at least one lawsuit threatened by a woman who said her husband had food, water, and medication withheld from him after he was recovering from coronavirus because the doctor felt he had no quality of life, and he died 6 days later. So we're seeing changes in the treatment of patients and subjects that are very disturbing, and they're not always even conforming to the law. The law that I'm describing, it does not afford much protection of subjects, but even that law sometimes seems to be, you know, being ignored. So we really have a lot of challenges.
Could I have just a few more quick questions? Because this is so fascinating and troubling at the same time. With the vaccine preparation and all the research that went into it with Pfizer and with Moderna and Johnson & Johnson, was there any reluctance on the part of the African-American community to participate in those tests? And what about what people call vaccine hesitancy?
Okay, well, in terms of the trials, we were told every day that African-Americans were not participating, that they were afraid because of Tuskegee. That is not true. Look at the final data. What you find is 10% of the subjects in both the Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech trials were African-American. African-Americans constitute 12.3% of the American population, which means they were volunteering at a rate commensurate with their rate in the population. There was no widespread hesitancy or refusal to join trials, even though we read every single day that there was. And now we're reading that African Americans are rejecting the vaccine. But when you read the article, I'm looking for data that is not there. Very often what they give is data showing that African Americans are less likely to receive the vaccine. That doesn't mean that they don't want it. That means they're not getting it. So what's standing between them and the vaccine? Is it really the hesitancy they're talking about every day? Or is it actually policies and practices that separate African Americans from healthcare? We know that some of the policies do indeed lower African Americans' chance of getting the vaccine. For example, the focus on the elderly, which seems quite logical and quite, you know, ethical. But the reality is that if you look at elderly people in this country, twice as many white people are in the 90-plus age range as black people. The minority populations in this country are very young. There's lower life expectancy, and both African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Native Americans are all younger on average than white populations. Many African Americans never reach that age of 85 that put them in the first priority group. Yeah.
And there's also the fact that a lot of people are cutting the line and using influence, and we know there are some people who have more influence in our society than others. In closing, you want this book, Carte Blanche, to be a call to action. What can we do? I mean, because this sounds horrific on its face, so much of what we've been talking about. So what do we do about it?
This has all been escalated by two laws passed in 1996. Go to the Code of Federal Regulations. I have the laws right in the book. You can look them up online for yourself and read them. These two laws permit this. The law is the source of the problem. The solution lies in the law. I want everybody who is concerned about this to contact their lawmaker, whatever group that you're a part of, you know, your sorority, your alumni group, whatever group you're a part of, if you can make this an action item for them, to put pressure on lawmakers to revisit these laws and take them off the books. They simply are incompatible with ethics. They're incompatible with the human rights of American citizens, and we simply can't tolerate having them there.
Are there any advocates of that in Congress? Is there anybody who's taken this up as their cause, or is it really an orphan right now and no one has really picked up on this?
I think it's a bit of an orphan right now because there's so little knowledge of it, but also because of lobbyists in Congress. I am dramatically opposed to lobbyists in Congress. These people take the money of companies like pharmaceutical companies to induce lawmakers to pass laws that will benefit companies but work against the interests of Americans. And I'm quite sure that this presence of lobbyists is part of the problem.
Fascinating. You are amazing. Harriet Washington, the book, in terms of a recommendation, Ibram X. Kendi, and of course he's written some really provocative books, says it's urgent, alarming, riveting, and essential. And that's the best way to describe it. I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you so much.